Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. It sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. It sounds like a whisper.
Political theater and revolution in the 20th century, presented by the Theatre Studies Programme of the Mediterranean Institute at the University of Malta, coordinated by Dr. Vickianne Cremona. Today's programme is Brecht and Marxist Ideology with Yulia Budianskaya and Magda von Kaulenberg. Hello, Yulia. Hello, Magda. And once again, thank you to our listeners for tuning into this program, which is going to take us into a discussion about Brecht, a very, very important theater director of the 20th century, as well as an author, actually, and Marxist ideology. I'd just like to say en passant that a book has just been produced by the University of Malta on the Marxist legacy of the Communist Manifesto. It's a series of papers that have been written by various scholars within the university, and it might be interesting for our listeners to want to look at a copy of it. Right, so let's go to Brecht. And, well, who was this Brecht? What do we know about him?
Well, actually, this Brecht was born on the 10th February 1989 in Augsburg, Germany. And he was obviously one of the greatest playwrights and directors in modern Germany. Now, his style of writing actually espoused this Marxist ideology. He wrote in a very poetic style, yet he had this informal type of dialogue in his plays. During his youth, he rebelled against his background and he rejected his religion and started picturing himself as a proletarian.
Yes, in fact, he came, though, from a bourgeois background,
yes.
Didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, at the beginning, he was studying medicine.
Yes, in fact. Mm-hmm. His plays gave him very much international reputation, but funnily enough, Russia, the country we would much more, you know, picture as Marxist, was the plays were least produced there. And he didn't even make it to the Broadway commercial theatres. As we said, he was studying medicine, but he began his start He started his theatrical career around 1922 with his plays Ball and Drums in the Night. Then in 1924, he moved to Berlin, where he became a dramaturg at the Deutsches Theater. And he started actually collaborating with famous directors such as Reinhardt, Jessner and Piscator.
Actually, the fact that Brecht had a medical background is an important fact, however, in his life, and is going to influence even his theatre and the analytical way he looks at it, for the simple reason that Brecht goes to the front because he is called up as a medical orderly, being a medical student, and like Piscator, witnesses the war, is totally disgusted by it, and the first plays he's going to write, you have spoken of Ball, are revolutionary anarchist plays, also provoked by his rejection of what humankind can do to others. It's interesting to see that whereas Piscator is influenced by Dadaism, we can say that Brecht is influenced by another type of anarchy. So shall we enter this phase of Piscator's life and discuss it a little bit, this phase of his first theatrical productions? We know that Ball was a totally destructive character with a poetic streak to him. He sings songs. He plays the guitar very much like Brecht, isn't he?
Yes, and actually it corresponds to the time when Brecht decided to study Marxist ideology. It came during 1926 when Brecht decided to put a performance. And actually he didn't know much about marketing, about the system, how the capitalist society works. So he was interested what Marx said about that. And he was so fascinated that he even decided to go on some courses on Marxist ideology. And this happened during 1926-1927. These courses were run by Marxist heretic Karl Kirsch, whom later became a good friend to Brecht. Well, Brecht, need to be said, was really fascinated by the ideology of Marx. And the situation in the United States, which we all know as the Great Depression, confirmed Marxist ideas that capitalist society could not lead to a happy future whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And, well, actually, we can say that his whole influence at that period, I mean, we've seen that he's already lived through through the World War One, and there is not only economic depression in America, but there is a huge economic depression in Germany. This is the period between the two World Wars. At one point, we have the Weimar Republic. Yeah. We have the complete collapse of the Deutschmark, where it is not, the money. It becomes worthless. I mean, just a bit later. So all these social and political upheavals, we've just had the Russian Revolution, etc. All these social political upheavals are totally transforming and, in a sense, building up Brecht's ideology. But so how can we say that he uses this ideology in his own work?
Well, it actually reflects a lot, his work, because he always believed that art, and especially theatre, should always support ideology. Obviously, his theatre was very dubbed as Marxist, and he was even the subject matters and the materials he used for his plays were always conditioned by the working class and the relations to power. He used a lot, social, historical, and this famous dialectical approaches to his plays. And something important that he always said is that theatre must be an agent of a social and political change, and that is why he sought a suitable form of theatre, and this brought him to epic theatre.
Interestingly enough, Brecht's work can be considered in three stages. The first one is early plays of Brecht, where he attacked naturalism, realism, when he was against capitalist society, when he was against bourgeoisie values. The second period, or the second stage, is Brecht's propagandist plays, or Lehrstück, which we're going to talk a bit later. But this period lasted from 1928 till 1931. And the last period, or the third stage, is Brecht's place of his maturity, where he inserted and interludes, adaptation, different operas, so a great output was there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so which plays, however, would you say are very important, or actually, how does he develop his themes within the plays?
Need to be said that his epic theatre, what he calls it, how he explains that the epic poet presents the event as totally past, while the dramatic poet presents it as totally present.
What's very interesting, what he wanted actually to do with his epic theatre was actually to do away completely with all the traditional theatrical effects. Mm-hmm. He wanted completely to create a non-illusionistic theatre, and he didn't want nothing to be identified with. A very important element in this epic theatre was this notion of historization. Now, he believed that history prevented this identification, and in his epic theatre, Brecht sought to eliminate the historical specific features of an environment in order to show that the environment influenced, shaped, and often destroyed his characters. Brecht was much more interested in the attitudes and the behaviors of the people, which they adopted towards the events that happened through their life, through history. And this can be shown even through Mother Courage, how she behaved as the war went along with the tradespeople, with the soldiers, and even with her family.
So yes, basically Mother Courage being this woman who sells wares, food and other wares to the soldiers on the front, who has her wagon and who sacrifices, who is a victim of this war and of the very soldiers to whom she sells her wares, because the war kills her children. And she remains completely alone. Therefore, we can say that this fact of not wanting this identification means that Brecht wants his spectator to attain another level, and he speaks of an effect that he tries to produce, where the term is directly lifted from Marxism, isn't it? He speaks of the Verfremdung effect, or as it is known in English, the alienation effect. So can we talk about this?
Alienation effect. Oh, well, interestingly, as you just mentioned, this alienation effect comes from Marxist idea, Hegelian philosophy, and Russian formalist Viktor Shklovsky, who actually coined this term. Alienation effect, or literally means making strange device. However, in Brecht's theater, alienation effect is there for people to become aware of the situation, just like in Marxist ideology, who thought that people, in order to achieve a greater stage of their life or revolution, should become aware of the situation.
It was even in his theatre, Brecht used this alienation effect. He used it through his style of acting, through his style of writing, through his style of staging, and through his music. And they always actually punctuated this loose, the stage was never attached or blended to what to the characters, to the music. So they were always separate, but yet somehow they were fused together in order to enhance this alienation effect.
You can have a very dramatic thing happening on stage and very romantic music in the background, or vice versa. He doesn't try to create a correspondence between the elements. Up to a certain extent, it's what you were speaking about before. He is going totally against naturalism, and he makes the distinction between the dramatic theatre and epic theatre, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And as you were actually saying, going against naturalism, the alienation effect was actually there because he didn't want the people to forget that they are in the theatre. So he wanted actually this effect, so he broke all illusions. And this is because he didn't want the people to identify what was actually happening on stage.
Because identification does not allow thought.
Because that's what he actually wanted. He wanted people to think, and therefore, through the thought, change was brought about.
Mm-hmm. And the way he brings about this thought is actually to fragment. The minute you begin to believe and identify with the character, he breaks the illusion for you to start thinking about what the character has just said.
This was to bring, even as we said, the music, for example, because the music, the rhythm of the music, doesn't follow the rhythm of the words. As you said, you can have a kind of tragic moment and the music is so soft and so, you know, this calm mood. And as well, the stage, how he used the stage, for example, for people to be aware of the situation, it was brightly lit, so everyone could see everyone. Everyone could see what is going on stage. The musicians, they were on stage, so every one of them was equal. I mean, we don't have the hierarchy. And he took it from Marx as well, because at the high stage of Marx, people are equal, they share everything. And then how he used even the placards, or, for example, when people were... Okay, it's a human nature to identify themselves with the character. But then at the same time, they see the placards with strong ideas, don't do that, don't do that. So they are aware of the situation yet again.
Actually, it's a new way of appealing to the public, isn't it?
Yes.
Of bringing the audience into the act obliging them to focalize both on social aspects, on political aspects, on life aspects.
Definitely.
Even one of his first important plays, like Threepenny Opera, refers to the gay opera by which is written in the 18th century. But again, what we have are not the bourgeois people and all their vices or virtues, etc. But we have common people, even gangsters being staged. And he shifts the interest, in fact, of the characters already. The characters we see are far more coming far more from the working class than from the bourgeoisie.
Yes. Actually, going back to this notion of thought and that he actually wanted to provoke thought into people, he actually used this scientific approach. Now, as we know in science, we always analyze, observe, and then think in order to get a result. Now, that is what actually he wanted the people to do whilst watching his plays. He always believed that people have to watch the play, think about it, and then get their own ideas. So he never actually wanted to give an answer in the conclusion of his plays. He never wanted an answer. So the people would actually think, bring their own ideas, and then say, sort of, okay, now this will happen or this will happen. So he wanted actually to provoke this thought, and it was only through this thought that change would actually happen, even politically ahead.
Right. And in fact, we come to this, he initiates a learning process. You mentioned before the Lehrstück, perhaps you Stücke, so you might want to develop this.
In fact, this Lehrstück was a phase between 1928 and 1931. It was prior to his exile. And he used to always consider these Lehrstücks as learning plays, which resembled political seminars. In fact, Brecht described them as a political collective meeting in which the audience was to participate actively. Now, what he wanted actually to do with these Lehrstücks was to politicize art and produce political education to the masses. Now, interestingly enough, even though the learning plays were done prior to the epic theatre, he always considered these learning plays to be far more superior to his epic theatre. In fact, he called the learning plays as grand pedagogy, because they actually turned the actors and the audience into statesmen and philosophers. He used to call the epic theatre as the lesser pedagogy, because it only democratized theatre in a pre-revolutionary period, whereas these Lehrstücks made the people to think more, observe, and sort of be much more into a collective meeting. Now,
pre-revolutionary plays as reference to Marx, no?
Yes.
Where the revolution has to be accomplished.
He abolished totally the system of the actor and the spectator in these Lehrstücks, and these actors and spectators actually participated in a more direct and creative manner to the aesthetic and to the play that they're watching. In fact, very interesting enough, he used to invite his audience to smoke during his plays, and because he always believed that whilst you're relaxed and you're smoking, you could actually think more, observe more, and then you could actually discuss the issues that you've actually watched in a better way.
Interestingly, I wonder what he would have done in Malta when the new law is going to be passed about smoking. He was a very heavy smoker himself, so just a little detail.
Well, apart from scientific approach in epic theatre, dialectical approach takes one of the important part in his ideas in his theatre and his writing. Well, what is dialectical approach? Interesting enough, yet again, this dialectical approach comes from Marxist ideology, Hegelian philosophy. We all know this Hegel philosophy of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Well, what did Brecht actually do? He explained that the principle of this dialectical approach lies in the fact that recent history shows a development from feudalism, thesis, to capitalism, antithesis, and which lead to a synthesis in socialism. For example, which play we can explain? Let's take Mother Courage. You explained the story that Mother Courage travels through war. She is in a way a capitalist, and she needs to survive, and she needs to feed her children. How this dialectical approach appears here? We know the scene when peasants are still sleeping. The enemy is close. And Mother Courage, she is absent. She's somewhere. She's trying to find money to survive. She's a small capitalist. While the only person who is awake is Catherine. And she is, in a way, a synthesis in this triangle, if I may say so. So, repeat once again. We have peasants, and they are thesis. We have Mother Courage. She is capitalist. She is antithesis. And the one person whose behavior is to solve the whole community is Catherine. She is synthesis. She is socialism in Marxist ideas.
Yes, I think an aspect that it is important to mention when we speak of the dialectical approach is the fact that Brecht doesn't simply want a theatre with political content. He wants to change man's way of thinking and man's way of being. Therefore, he believes that the political action of the theatre is to transform man. And he derives this directly from Marx and Marx's concept of dialectics. So what he's going to work on, and it's interesting that you created this triangle concept, because he focuses on the intersubjective relations between men and how these intersubjective relations are going to influence man's outlook towards life. And this is what the actor expresses. However, I think that in trying to create these relationships and giving the onus to the actor, Brecht also defines a new way of acting, doesn't he? So
yes.
Well, yes, you're right, because what we can say is that the Brechtian style of acting is acting in quotation marks. Well, what do you mean by this? As we said before, actor should not impersonate, should not just identify himself with the character. Actor is the one who is all the time in process of thinking. He controls his emotions. It is the one who narrates the action of another person. Actor's performance should be the delivery of finished product. The story is the point of interest, not the character. The Brechtian actor is to work at expressing social attitudes in clear and stylized ways through gestures. Gestures is everything an actor does in terms of gestures, stance, what we call right now body language, intonation, in order to show the significance of some ideas.
Yes, in fact, I think that gestus is a very important concept when we're related to Brecht, because he makes a huge distinction between the traditional gesture and gestus. Gest has a moral connotation to it, and therefore both gesture and gestus are going to reveal something. Gesture is going to reveal a subjective personal state, whilst gestus is going to reveal a social state. Right, so what about his exile?
This period, which lasted for 10 years, from 1933 till 1943, is also very interesting in Brecht's life, because he continued to write plays. And what is more interesting, during this period, Brecht wrote a book which he called More Tea, or Métis, as they called. What it is, Métis is a collection of works of major Marxist theorists. But Brecht was clever enough not to call those Marxian theorists by their names, such as Lenin, Rosa Luxemburg, or Karl Kirsch. He used Chinese pseudonyms and thus created new characters. For example, Lenin became Mi and Len. And thus, reader is in a way has a dialogue with major theorists and then decides for their own sake what they're talking about.
It's interesting to know that after Brecht seeks exile in America, I mean, he goes around the world, but then he settles in America for a period. He too has to go back to Germany because of McCarthyism. And in Germany, what is interesting that he chooses to stay in East Germany rather than West Germany because of his ideology. What is so particular about this East German period anyway?
Yes, actually he finally managed to create his concept of ensemble through the founding of the Berliner Ensemble under his name of his wife Helen Vigo, and they lived together as a community and created theatre and actually could focus upon what he actually wanted to achieve, this ensemble ideal.
And actually what we can say about Marxist connection to, about Brecht's connection to Marxist ideology, that he found Marxism as a productive source of ideas for the understanding of works of art and for revolutionizing of art at all. So, and we can even conclude with his phrase, "When I read Marx's Capital, I understood my place."
Well, that's a very appropriate way of ending this program, I must say. We've had a very fruitful discussion about Marx. I thank both Magda and Julia for being here with me. I also thank our listeners for, again, for listening into this program. I hope you enjoyed it. And I would like to invite you next week to listen to The Theatre of the Absurd and Existentialism and its Political Meaning.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know, you better run, run, run. Finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around, waiting for a promotion. Don't you know?